Jennifer Fraser, thank you so much for being here. Jennifer is the author of The Bullied Brain, Heal Your Scars and Restore Your Health. Jennifer documents extensive brain science to draw on her innovative strategies. She's also a consultant using evidence-based practices to transform outdated bullying and abuse cultures into happy, healthy, high-performing ones. Amazing. Jennifer also writes a great series for Psychology Today called The Bully Brain. Please check it out. Jennifer, thank you so much again for taking part in this conversation titled Navigating Workplace Bullying, Finding Resilience and Feeling Joy, Even in Crisis. Hello there.
Hey, Andy. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to discuss this with you.
You take such an interesting perspective and approach to this issue of workplace bullying. So I want to get right into it. Let me ask this first, because I've read a lot about you. This is the first time we've really had a chance to talk, and I'm so interested in all that you have to bring to this issue. So you say, as it pertains to incivility, aggression, bullying, learn to work with your brain, not against it. And I have a feeling that I've been working against my brain for much of my life, let alone my professional career in television in New York. Can you just start with that and give us a general framework?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, as anyone listening knows, we live in a society, we live in a culture that ignores the brain. So in my title, I was playing with that a little bit. I'm the same as everybody else. We all bully our own brains because we ignore them. And as we know, one of the most painful things you can do to someone else is act like you don't think that they're valuable or they don't have any meaning or you don't even see them. When they speak, you don't hear them. When they write you an email, you don't answer. That's ignoring, ostracizing. Those kinds of behaviors are really, really harmful. But we grew up this way. Our brains are wired to believe that they don't matter, that we're not going to factor them into our basic decision-making. We don't factor them into our health. We don't think about checking them or assessing them or making sure they're healthy and high production. Like, no. So I came at this whole subject through a bullying crisis. I would never have gotten to the place where I was doing a deep dive into the brain science if I hadn't been confronted with a social norm that was telling me that bullying didn't matter. It wasn't really a problem. How come I was having this big reaction? And I'm a researcher by training. My PhD is in comparative literature. We were trained to take information, expertise out of the silos where they don't talk to each other and put them into the arena, see how the conversation changes. So I took bullying and I put it into the arena with the brain. And that combination was pretty shocking.
Yeah. How did the bullying that you experienced or that you observed or both manifest itself and how did it affect you?
Ooh, that is a long answer because it affected me on a whole variety of ways that really fascinated me. I mean, as a person, no, it wasn't fascinating to be very ill. It wasn't fascinating to be incredibly riddled with anxiety or start to have panic attacks or none of these things, suffer depression. I mean, these are just, textbook responses to being in a culture in the workplace that's highly abusive. I mean, it's just so well documented in the research, but most people don't know the research. So I had all the textbook reactions. On the flip side, though, you know, again, I'm a very privileged person to have had extensive academic training and education. And because of that, you know, the physical, human, feeling, caring part of myself really suffered. The academic part of myself started looking at the research going, okay, everybody needs to know this. Yeah. This is incredibly serious information and it's life-saving and I've got to get it out there as an educator. That's all I can really focus on.
Yeah. And was it one person? In my experience in television, it was usually either the CEO, the top person, or the number two who was spending a lot of time making sure that his relationship with the top person was solid so that he could misbehave and be ill-mannered as much as he wanted. Was it one person? And usually these things kind of become entire toxic environments, but was it one person who was doing the bullying in your experience?
No, it's more what you describe as the way I think about it and the way I talk about it in my writing is it's really like a contagion. You get a toxic environment because the individual who, so if you say the CEO, if the CEO or leadership of a company is abusive and uses bullying as a model or technique for whatever they think it's going, you know, psychologically, they're driven to do it. We can get into the brain science behind that if you like.
Yes, but please.
Basically, if you have that kind of contagious person at the top, just like you say, the next in command, well, the next in command is going to infect other people in the workplace because that's what happens. Abusive behaviors are highly infectious. And in fact, I mean, the research shows if you're a workplace that tolerates even microaggressions, those microaggressions are really good cover up for more abusive practices that are underneath the surface. Why? Because the environment's toxic. If you live in a city that is highly polluted, you're not going to notice a noxious gas that could kill you. But if you're in an environment where it's so heavily polluted that you can't really sort out the smog or the smell, or then you are at risk of really becoming ill. And that's exactly what bullying's like.
Yeah. And so before, because I want to talk about microaggressions, because you have some really interesting things to say about those kinds of things happening in the workplace. But let me ask you first, it just seems somewhat intuitive, but it's not, that treating people generally well will be good for you and others, even if you're doing it for self-interest, that if you treat people well, that they'll work harder, work better, be happier to come to work, be happier to stay at work. But it doesn't seem like very many leaders approach it that way, at least not in my experience. So let me ask you this. You talk a lot about how bullying has been normalized in the workplace and maybe in society too. We can talk more about perhaps the political discourse in this country and around the world, but let's keep it to the workplace for a minute. What do you mean when you talk a lot about how these behaviors have been normalized?
Well, the analogy I use for that, and I use it at the start of my book, The Bullied Brain, because it's a really good way to get us to understand. If there are young people listening to this, they might not quite get it, but they can find their own version. But for people you're in my age, we remember that when we were growing up in our formative years, so this is all wiring and sculpting our brains. Just a quick sidebar that everyone needs to understand. The brain is neuroplastic. It is not hardwired. You're not born with a certain brain and that's what you have for life. And after the age of 5, it doesn't change. That's debunked. That's not true. Neuroscientific research is conclusive and extensive. Your brain will change until your final day on the planet. It's highly affected, especially in your formative years, by your culture, by your environment that you're in. That can be home, school, sports, arts, higher education in the workplace. All those things are sculpting your brain. What's really exciting is all of us have the ability to change our own brains, just like we can change our own bodies based on what we practice. Now, our society hasn't taught us that, but it is just, again, it's a conclusive, peer-reviewed, replicated scientific fact. So if you take anything away from your and my conversation, I hope that you take away the understanding that no one can sculpt or wire your brain to be anything you don't let them do to you, because you could always put in practice things that will neutralize and change what they've done to you. And that's empowering. You have as much power to affect the health and the high performance of your brain as you do your body. Okay, so let's put that to the side. Here's the analogy to answer your question. The
Please.
Analogy I use is smoking. When you and I were growing up, Andy, everybody smoked.
Yep.
Your parents smoked, your grandparents, your workplace, everybody smoked, the airplane, bars, your doctor smoked a cigarette while he wrote you a prescription. Everybody
yeah.
smoked. It was normal.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, if you think intuitively, you kind of wonder, humans, it's sort of odd that we didn't go, maybe putting smoke into our bodies isn't going to be the best thing for our health and our lungs or our throat. But we did it anyways, because everybody did. Society did it. It was normalized.
Yeah.
Then they really marketed it hard, right? Like, I mean, we had the Marlboro Man. We had Audrey Hepburn. We were hammered with the messaging that the quicker and sooner we started smoking, the tougher we would be, the more productive we would be, the better would be, the more sophisticated would be, just like Hollywood. So we did it. Then they all of a sudden came out and said, oh, by the by, I hate to tell you this, but it doesn't make you tough. Makes you sick. It's going to give you cancer if you keep doing it. And we all had to change. This is where we're at. We are at a tipping point. You are on the cutting edge of it. We are at a tipping point in bullying culture. I believe we are watching it, and maybe we can say internationally, in a really very, very painful way. We're watching the last outraged, heaving, destructive breaths of the bullying and abuse paradigm. and it's got to give way. I swear we're not going to survive as a planet. It has got to give way to a new paradigm, which I argue is a neuro paradigm. It's brain informed. When we start factoring in our brains, which is our greatest gift, along with our body, we can change everything. We can even change this entrenched culture that we're stuck in right now that keeps telling us that bullying's really good for us and it's gonna meet the bottom line, et cetera. It's all myths. It's none of that's true.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by what you're saying. I think it's so interesting and so important. So let me ask this. I have to ask this before we get to microaggressions because I can't help but get my own stuff in there. So when I went to college years ago, I was in a fraternity and there was quite a bit of hazing. And I won't go into the kind of hazing, but I hated it. But I lived in the fraternity house. And if I quit, if I walked out, I would have nowhere to live. So I was kind of stuck. But during Hell Week, they did some really bad things to us, I think. Not where you had, where you were drinking and you might die. Nothing like that. But just, I didn't like it. I hated it. But some of my fellow classmates, the other pledges, thought it was kind of fun and funny and couldn't wait to do it to the people next year. And I said to myself, and I said it to the fraternity, I go, you try to do that next year, I'm going to report you to the university. I was so ashamed of what had happened to me, that these people could do this to me, that, you know, these were people who were just 1 year older than me, 2 years older than me. They were supposed to be my brothers. And so I just have to ask you, why do some people just kind of think this kind of stuff is funny and it washes off them? And other, I took it so personally, like, how could they do this to me? And they were bullying. It was, you know, hazing is bullying. So is there a kind of a quick, brief answer to why some of us kind of like it and can't wait to bully other people and other of us take it so personally and it affects our brains?
Oh, yeah. Let's do a quick run through that'll map out exactly who you were in that scenario and who the people are that said that they liked it. Okay.
Yeah.
So what we have to all understand is that our brain constantly, every minute that we are interacting with one another, we are navigating on an unconscious level. Our brain is doing this, our nervous system is doing this, and our body is doing it. And we're not aware of it. It's unconscious. But we are all navigating danger. We are constantly circling. It's how you and I are alive right now to talk to each other. We wouldn't be if our brains weren't really good at survival.
Uh-huh.
Our brains are watching for danger and threat. Now, our brains are, through evolution, they've been grown to believe that the threat is a predator. And it really is a predator, even when it's hazing and your brothers and a fraternity. It's a real threat to you. And you could die. We know the stats on hazing are horrifying. The kind of damage that they would have done to your brain arguably is pretty worrisome. Again, quick sidebar for everybody listening. In my work, what I have learned, and this is why I want to share it with everybody, most people don't know, when we can talk about this with microaggressions, most people don't know that all forms of bullying and abuse, all forms, capital A-L-L, all forms, have the power to do physical damage to your brain. You do not know you have an invisible wound, but you do. It leaves neurological scars and you start to blame yourself. Oh, I can't do this. I can't do that. I suffer from this. I need medication for that.
Or just, I'm a wimp. Why am I a wimp? And everybody
I'm
else.
A wimp. How come I didn't love the hazing like all the other guys did? Okay. So here's what the brain does. Automatic response. Your brain went into fight mode. You have a lot of power. You must come from a pretty powerful background that gave you a lot of self-esteem and a lot of confidence and a lot of independence. So you went to them and said, like, independence is crazy what you would have gotten. You had the power to go to them and say, ends with me. Here's what I'll do. I will report. That's powerful. That's fight.
Jennifer, but I didn't stop it. Shouldn't I have said, wait a minute. I didn't have the fortitude or the strength or
You're underestimating yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Saying that, you're in fight mode. Now that you've said that, let's do another quick sidebar. The quick sidebar is, you know, Maslow's hierarchy, everybody talks about Maslow's hierarchy. You get up to the top and you can have our connection and so on and so forth. But the brain's basic needs the self's basic needs, Maslow's hierarchy that everybody talks about, in that triangle, the key is we have to have food, we have to have shelter.
Mm-hmm.
From a brain point of view, that's not true. From the brain's point of view, we have to have food. We have to have shelter. We have to have connection and community. If we don't, we don't survive.
Mm-hmm.
Brain needs connection and community or it doesn't make it. And there's horrendous research I can share with you on how we know that. It's so awful, you don't even want to hear it. But the bottom line is, trust me when I say, the science is very clear. You could not afford, as a young person, just as you said, I lived there. It was your community. It was your family.
You it was my safety.
Afford. It's your safety. You couldn't afford to go against a group, but you still did. You took a fight stance and said, if you do this, I think this is sick. What you're doing is wrong. I will not participate. I will report. That's a power play.
Okay.
So there's here's the different things we do automatically. You luckily came from power. You answered with power. Fight, fight. You could have gone into flight. You could have left and got a dorm room and made everybody unhappy and disappointed your family and whatever. Lost your brotherhood. Who knows? You could have done flight, right? Fight, flight, freeze. Could have become paralyzed. I'm sure there were guys that went, I can't believe what I'm seeing. I'm not going to say or do anything. I'm going to keep my eyes on the ground. I'm going to get through this. I just have to survive this. That's freeze. Yeah. Then you got, and it's what you described, you've got fawn. The fawning person licks the boots of the dictator. The fawning person identifies with the aggressor. We've known this since Freud. They will be the yes man. They'll do anything. They'll sell their soul. It's close to the one in power because they're terrified.
Yeah.
You and I have talked briefly about Bobby Knight. You said everybody was afraid of him. He's a doddering old guy at 70 and they're still afraid of him. You know why? Because everyone is worried that they won't survive the encounter with the predator. It's better to identify with the aggressor and believe that he or she is doing the right thing than be in the uncomfortable position of being in the line, the firing line by saying. Yeah.
I know because you've looked at bullying in sports. And so I mentioned to you earlier, Bobby Knight was a very famous basketball coach at Indiana University here in the US. And I was his executive producer late in his life at 70. I did a television show with him on March Madness, the big basketball tournament here, college basketball tournament. And everybody was still scared to death of him. We'd have breakfast together, all this stuff. And whatever he wanted, he would never pay. Everyone's like, okay, Bob, don't you? You know, at 70, they were still scared of him because he was such a renowned bully. So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
So what I say about the Bobby Knights of the world, he pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. What happened was he probably had a random big success that started to attract to him all kinds of talented players. He had the money. He had the support of his university institution. He started to be able to build an empire because of a random one-time success. Everybody then started to say, hey, if you bully and abuse people, they're high performers. Bobby Knight is the greatest coach of all time. It's not his players that are spectacular and they're not performing despite abuse. It's that he's abusing them. That's what the brain does. The brain makes terrible mistakes. And anybody who wants to really understand high performance, I would recommend you don't look at Bobby Knight, whose players survived his regime of harm and probably a quite damaged brain.
Yes.
Steve Kerr. You want to see success? Yeah. Look at Steve Kerr. He's a basketball coach. Phil Knight is a basketball coach. John Wooden is a basketball coach. They are 10,000 times more successful than Bobby Knight ever was, but they all treat their players with empathy and care and humanity. So Bobby Knight, let's just think high performance in the workplace because it's one of the biggest myths out there. High performance in the workplace, think of it this way. If the brain is constantly looking for threats, if it's constantly pumping up the amygdala, which is the threat detection center of the brain, it doesn't have resources for creativity, collaboration, innovation, productivity. Like the brain is putting its resources into staying alive, into surviving, into licking the boots of the guy who's going to scream at them or humiliate them publicly or take away their opportunities. That is not a high performing brain. And the same thing applies to sport and every other context that we see this in.
So can I just assume that you have not found any data that would suggest that when someone's treating you with some form of aggression, lack of appreciation, incivility, that there's no data that you found in the brain where you work harder and better when you're being managed by someone like that?
So I love that you asked that question because I usually sort of create that question myself when I give presentations because I present a lot in front of sports. Yeah. And high-level sport and elite sport, and they have been sold the belief system, some of them, that in fact, and I write a chapter about this in my book, abuse is a necessary evil for greatness. So in the book, I really focus on the film Whiplash, because Whiplash was unpacking how is that really true? And it showed us all a highly abusive situation. And that was the abuser's argument. I have to do this to find, you know, the person that's the great talent, the greatness. I have to do it to all of you to make you great. That's the lie. So actual fact. So I'll say to guys, you know, at these big presentations, I'll be like, okay, I understand that you're saying, you know, I'm a safe sport lady and you don't want to hear from me. And everybody's got their phone up. They're looking at their watches and they're thinking about their lunch. And I'm just like, just let me say this. I say, fair enough. I know you don't want to hear this because you are being led falsely to believe that caring about safety means that you won't attain greatness. And you have to sell out safety and humanity and civility and care and compassion. All that has to be like taken off the table. And I say to them, I've got like so much research, I can't even fit it into this room. If I stacked up all my papers from doctors and psychiatrists and educators and sports experts and psychologists and neuroscientists and neurobiologists, we couldn't even, the room would be full. Can you just give me your research? All I want to do is see the research that says, in actual fact, abuse is a necessary evil for greatness. And I know they have no research. There's not a single scholar, no academic, no expert that will put their name to any form of research that makes that argument. But we as a society, it's like we believe smoking made us tough. We still need that outdated myth. Oh.
Brilliant, Jennifer. Just brilliant. Okay. So because I have another personal story that I want to share, but I want to get your expertise first. You mentioned microaggressions, kind of off-color remarks, slights in the workplace, you know, these kind of things. And I want to mention two real quick things. I acknowledge, by the way, my privilege. I acknowledge my white privilege, if you want to say that. In my career, I had certain advantages that other people didn't. But it didn't matter. I still got bullied. We all can be bullied. I don't care what your station is, where you started, where you ended, high profile job, high status, low status, union jobs, nonprofit, and all that. But I wanted to mention one particular circumstance, but I'd like to get your view of how these things take place, because nobody threw a stapler at my head. Nobody sexually harassed me. That's not what my experience is, and that's not the issue that I'm really addressing here, and I don't think it is yours either. There are some laws about that, but we'll put that aside for a second. So my question is, how do these things, these microaggressions, affect the brain and affect people's performance and feeling in the workplace?
So what happens is, we've been led astray again by our society, because we have laws that are laid out that tell us that if somebody harms someone else's body, then the law takes that very seriously. There's criminal charges, there's likely conviction, right? And that's because we have this outdated system at work. We are not using, so it's interesting. Let me just sidebar for a second. Yeah. I was asked to speak in front of the Massachusetts Senate about the science. So the Massachusetts Senate is trying to make a decision. They're really wanting to pass a psychological safety law, but they're not sure which one they should do. So I was brought in on one side and there's another side. The other side says, and they were written that, there was a wonderful article written in the Boston Globe. And in that article, the reporter, the journalist did a fabulous job. They laid out the both sides. So they laid out the side, but they ended on the lawyer for the other side, not what I was arguing.
Okay.
The lawyer said, you know, like, I understand that this is important. Psychological safety is important, but you cannot hold the institution accountable because it's really about mindset. And it's really about integrity, and you can't measure it. And I was so mad that I was like, okay, the last thing that's going to happen, we all know, is that they're going to publish a letter to the editor written by a Canadian. It's not going to happen. But I was so mad. I was like, awesome. I'm going to tell you what I think anyways.
Yes,
so good, only up to 100 words. So I wrote to the Boston Globe and I said, look, that's incorrect. I mean, lovely, you know, the lawyer's doing his job and of course, but the law is out of date. Here's what the science says. The science says you can absolutely measure what has happened, what happens to a person from these kinds of repeat chipping away slights, microaggressions, insults, off-color jokes, kind of maybe harassment-y type of locking opportunity, taking your work and calling it their own. We all know the myriad of ways where you can be really targeted in the workplace. Doesn't matter who you are. And yes, I acknowledge privilege too. And I can't even imagine what it would be like for someone who doesn't have the privilege being put in these horrible situations.
Right.
So what does it do to the brain? And can we measure it? Yes, we can. Can we see it on a brain scan? Absolutely. Can we see it on an fMRI? Yeah. Can we do a biomarker test and see if cortisol is shooting up in the body? Yeah. No problem. Spit test? Yeah. Can we measure heart rate? Yeah. Can we measure blood pressure? Mm-hmm. Can we see that there is ultimately lots of health implications, you know, gut responses that are going to result in illness? Absolutely. But here's what we see on the brains. If you are constantly being bathed in a toxic environment at work, even if it seems as small, it's not the stapler being thrown at your head, but the law tells you that if the stapler got thrown, you would be hurt. And the law tells you that if you're suffering this repeat chipping away at your sense of selfhood, that you just don't need to worry about it. Why? Because they don't look at your brain. Here's what your brain would look like. What they have found in the research is if you have three kids and one kid's being physically abused, okay, staplers got thrown at their head multiple times. You've got another kid that's being sexually abused. And that's happened, you know, repeat. And then the third kid is being verbally abused. Okay. They've had the yelling in the face. They've had the put downs, but no one touched their body. Those three brains look very similar in terms of the abuse that they've suffered. And the abuse is physical.
Yeah.
What kind of abuse do we see? We see an enlarged amygdala. The threat detection center's getting all the resources and energy. We see a shrunken hippocampus. The hippocampus is the learning and memory center of the brain. And guess what? If it's constantly being in a toxic environment, it's getting cortisol. Cortisol is a corrosive stress hormone. It should be shooting up to save you when you're facing a saber-toothed tiger or a guy throwing a stapler, but it is ill-prepared to deal with 21st century microaggressions that are meant to make you feel like you don't matter, you don't count, you're not worthy and you don't belong. Those are deadly things for the brain, even though the law doesn't recognize them. And so the hippocampus looks shrunken. Here's one final other example. The corpus callosum, which is the bundle of fibers between the left and right hemisphere. It's critical for performance that those two hemispheres are talking to each other 100 miles an hour. So the corpus callosum gets myelinated. That means it gets like insulation on the wires that have to do with the importance of electrical super fast communication. It gets eroded when you are in that kind of an environment and everyone's telling you it's fine. How come you're so upset? It's not a big deal. So bad for you.
So interesting. So if you'll allow me, let me tell you a quick bullying story that I have. And again, it plays right into this because some people listening to this and fair may say, hey, you know, man up, so to speak. Sorry for the gendered language. But this guy was a bully and he did a lot of things. He got people fired. So this is just one thing. But I remember it like yesterday because it was so hurtful. And yet it was such a little thing, it seemed to me. And I want to get your and by the way, if you think I'm being too sensitive, you can tell me, but I hope you won't. So. I was, I think my position was vice president of original program. I was head of content at this sports media company. And the bully was the number two guy who had a great relationship with the number one guy. And they were kind of simpatico. So he felt like he had free, you know, range to treat people any way he wanted. In any event, we were having a meeting with some clients, some possible funders, big meeting. We had a new kind of intern type person who was responsible for getting the food for this early morning meeting. Well, the food didn't come. And this guy's frantic. The CEO's frantic because we have to have food and drink, bagels and orange juice and stuff. So this kid's frantic. What do I do? They didn't deliver the breakfast. Somebody said, go get it. And nobody was helping this kid. And he was like beside himself. So I'm like, I'll help you. I had nothing to do with ordering, delivering. That wasn't my job, but I wanted to help. I felt bad for this kid and I wanted to help the organization. We're in New York City. We run down the street. We gather up all this stuff. We carry it back, you know, running in the hopes that we can make it before the meeting starts. And luckily we did. The people running a little bit late. But as I'm coming in with this intern type person, we walk into the meeting where the entire staff is there, the executive staff plus the CEO. And the bully says, as I'm putting the stuff down, Jesus, Regal, you can't even produce breakfast. And, you know, my job was to be a producer. And I was so flummoxed and ashamed because I wanted to have the right retort. I'm not good at that in the moment. And if I got mad, it would show that it bothered me. And it kind of showed me as weak and feckless But I didn't know how to respond. And I remember like yesterday, I'm sure he doesn't remember it at all, but boy, oh boy, did it hurt. And I was ashamed and embarrassed in front of everyone. Like I didn't matter. I wasn't really an executive. And I was, you know, a target for this kind of microaggression. So does that resonate with you, or was I being too sensitive?
No, that is a textbook example. There's a number of things that you did that would really open up the door to a person that is abusive. Uh-huh. And so for number one, the one certain things they cannot stand, and that would be integrity. So they don't like to see integrity. That's uh-huh. You're putting the, you're doing the right thing, and they hate that. Uh-huh. And you're also showing compassion. You're caring and supporting and helping a kid, and they yeah. can't stand that. Because those integrity and compassion are not mirrors that reflect back to them their power. And it's all, that actually would have caused him to have had a really dysregulated response, because yeah. you're not licking his boots. You're not uh-huh. aggrandizing him. You're not reflecting him back to the room as you took the spotlight. That was your big mistake. You took the goodness, the energy, the everything that institution probably would like to convey to its funders, which is you guys work together. You're right. You thought you're lowest of the low, top of the top. It doesn't matter. You guys are worth investing in because you're a tight run ship. And when things go wrong, you problem solve. Every single thing you did would have made him massively insecure and uh-huh. threatened his standing. Now, what people don't understand is that, and we should be catching this as quickly as possible with children, because our children reflect our bullying culture, just like children started smoking back when all the adults were smoking. So we are training our kids to be bullies. All of us have brains that are born wired for empathy. It is the way you survive in the human jungle. Why? Because you get really good at understanding the feelings, the thoughts, and the intentions of the powerful people in the room. You get really good at reading it, and you're born that way. So if you're a kid, let alone an adult, and you're starting to manifest bullying behaviors, you're waving the red flag of deficits in the brain and of mental illness. But we have a culture that tells you you're powerful. Hey, just like when you're smoking, you're tough. When you manifest bullying, aggressive behaviors and hurt other people, you've got power. You have a power imbalance and you're hurting the victim. You've got to switch that culture. Same thing in the workplace. In the workplace, you should have had someone who said to the guy that made that comment, oh my goodness, that's really unfortunate that you are behaving this way in front of everyone at the funding meeting, because you're demonstrating that there's really a weak link in our executive team. You're waving the red flag of mental illness right in front of our funders. I think you need to go to your office, call your doctor and a psychiatrist and get some work done, because none of us would want to see your brain on a brain scan. Because you know what you would see? Anyone who makes a comment like that, if you and me were put into a brain scan and they showed us a bunch of images. They showed us images of an executive being humiliated, a kid in tears because they can't get the job done and they didn't, it's not their fault, but they can't fix it. They're just a kid. No one's helping them. A little old lady getting bumped off the street on Fifth Avenue, and a car is going to hit her, and a dog that is being beaten by its master. Okay. And a woman being sexually harassed. Okay. We get those images. We're in the fMRI machine. Our brains, and we can't help it, the brain scan doesn't lie. We couldn't lie our way out of a psychological test like you can in the workplace. Get me into the military or get me into this high-level position. I'll write my psychological test and I will lie every step of the way because I'm not stupid. I'm super smart. I know how to put on the pantomime, the masquerade, the manipulation. I am a wolf in sheep's clothing. I'm a master at it, a master manipulator. Yeah. Can't do it on a brain scan. Okay, so you and me are in the fMRI machine that show us these images. We can't help it. Our brains go electric in the affective empathy. Affective empathy is the part of your brain that says, I will never humiliate a kid like I was humiliated. You walk in their shoes. You feel their pain. That's your humanity. It's everything that makes you someone who is not going to hurt someone else. That's how we all survive. Okay, that's affective empathy. It's feelings. It's seeing the world through someone else's eyes and being there with them. Okay, so all of those images would upset us, our brains. And we would also have real reaction in the emotional centers. It's those reactions are what makes us feel guilt, remorse, go and apologize after the meeting and just say, you know what, I felt insecure. I am so sorry I said that. I'm a jerk. Yeah. How can I make it up to you? Never again, I promise. I'm going to work on myself, anger management or insecurity training, whatever it is. I'm really sorry, Andy.
Yeah.
You didn't get that, right? Okay. So let's imagine we took that guy and we put him in the fMRI scanner and we showed him the identical pictures that you and me saw. He can't make his brain lie on a brain scan. He can't, no matter how much he wants to. No emotional lighting. That's why he didn't come and apologize. There's no guilt. There's no remorse. There's no sadness. There's nothing. He doesn't feel anything for you except that you threatened him and he had to do an ego display. He had to show power. And the only way he knows how to do it is to humiliate you. Probably comes by it honestly from abuse and neglect. He doesn't become that guy. He's groomed the higher up. He's shown him Dr. Jekyll, but he shows really Mr. Hyde to anyone that is threatening his power. And so he fires them. Anyone that makes him insecure, he gets rid of them or humiliates.
Okay. Yes.
But you got him in the brain scanner. One more thing. There's no affective empathy. It's extinguished. It's called empathy erosion. That neural network that we should all have secure from childhood is gone in that guy.
Yeah.
And there's no emotion. You know what lights up for him? What lights up in his brain when he sees those really distressing pictures? Language and cognition. If you want to be a liar and a gaslighter and groom higher ups, just like you groom your targets, if you want to create a whole illusion of your power, you have to be really, really good at language and you have to be really smart. You have to have a lot of cognition.
Oh, I believe that my bullies were, you know, really smart. They were often good business people, good with political stuff. So fascinating, Jennifer. Amazing. And thank you for that, because that gives me a lot of context that I've never had before about that circumstance, which I think about all the time. It happened over 20 years ago. In the few minutes we have remaining, I want to talk about a new book that you've got coming out, Jennifer, in the fall of 25, called The Gaslit Brain. And now that we have a better sense of your expertise and your background, what will The Gaslit Brain talk about and what will be the central theme?
Well, it's always for the individual when you write a book, of course, as you know, you're writing a book, but this book is for leadership and it's for HR, because they are the big influencers on how we're going to change our culture going forward. So The Gaslit Brain is, I'll just give you the subtitle and that quickly sort of starts to clarify where I'm trying to go with this.
Okay.
It's protect your brain from the lies of bullying, gaslighting, and institutional complicity. Because as we all know, what happens far too often in the workplace is a person comes forward, multiple people come forward. They say, so-and-so is abusive. This is what he or she is doing, or this little team is doing. It's really destructive. They're causing immense harm. They're putting the company at risk. And HR is put into the extremely awful position far too often of saying, you know what? You're a problem. We're going to do an internal investigation. We're going to find that your allegations don't have the evidence required and you're going to be let go. We need to get rid of you. You're the problem.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do is say, okay, we need a systems change. We need to exit the coercion control model. It's not working. It's not good for the 21st century. We need to change our attitude with complainants. People that come forward and tell us the difficult truth about what's going on are our most valuable employees. They've got fight. They've got courage. They're telling us the straight goods. They're so courageous. They're truth tellers. And those people, what we find in business is if you protect those people and you protect their brains and you respect them and you hear them and you let them be a valuable contributor to what's going on. There's an extensive research project out of Harvard, 15 years of data, and the 15 years of data shows if your company does that, you will be more productive and more profitable. But we operate under the myth still. We've got all these outdated myths, especially since we ignore our brains. We operate believing that if you get rid of the whistleblower and you just keep the status quo, then you'll just lurch forward with what you've got. And it's because of what you know. And the brain doesn't like change. The brain loves the status quo. A really good example of this is fitness. If you have been sitting on the couch and watching Netflix all through COVID, it's going to be hard to get off the couch and start jogging or biking or whatever. We know this. And the brain will tell us, don't. Just put the chips. Let's calm down. We'll do it tomorrow. The brain is our worst enemy that way. But when we tell our brain, you know what? You got to just do it. It's called activation energy. Just got to do it. We got to change the status quo at work. Hard to do. It's not a quick fix, but we got to change. And it's going to make our company more profitable and more productive. And it's going to keep talent. And it's not going to have high turnover rates. And it's going to be healthy and so on and so forth. There's nothing to lose by doing it. We just have to get our brains on side and encourage our brains and promise them that in 6 months, it's going to feel a lot easier and be a lot more inspiring and exciting. But that it's a systems change book. I'm really trying to get, you know, corporate workplaces in particular, because they lead and they're influencers, get them to understand this is the best thing possible. You're stuck in this destructive, like broken record. Like you look at the workplaces, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Jerry Sandusky, like how many times do we have to read about Boy Scouts and the police force? And it's like, no, we can change.
And we should, and we have to. And your expertise and your research is amazing. It's important. It's helpful. And it's fascinating. And I thank you for that. It's what a conversation. I've learned so much. I'm sure everyone watching and listening would like to learn more from you as well. What's the best way to contact you, Jennifer?
Well, the best way to reach me is through my website. So it's bulliedbrain.com. And there's a contact form. And if you say that you're a part of Andy's summit, I will answer you. I promise 100%. Might take me a little while, but I promise an answer to whatever it is that you'd like information on. I'd love to end on one fast note that we didn't have time to talk about, but I want your listeners to know. In the research, I learned all this information about how all forms of bullying and abuse damage the brain. But I also learned, and I built into the book every step of the way, your brain is wired to repair and recover. It is a miracle what it can do. There are evidence-based, like science-based practices to follow. They're not expensive. They're not difficult. They take time, but they are very clear. They're common sense, and they're very doable. And I just want you to know that if you have been hurt, if you have been bullied, that doesn't matter. You can totally change your brain through neuroplasticity and get it right back to organic health. All of us can.
Great point. Positive note. Thank you. And it is possible. You're not alone. And the research proves it. So thank you for that, Jennifer. One final word from me. We call ourselves bully targets, but now let's aim to change the workplace for good. Thank you for watching.